SBS, a world of difference. You're with NITV Radio, on mobile, online and on radio.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land NITV Radio broadcasts from, the Cammeraygal people and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes and clans we broadcast to. From the mountains to the plains, from the desert to the sea, from fresh water to salt water. Yiridamarang, hello, I'm your host Luana Grant and welcome to NITV Radio for this Wednesday, the 15th of May. Coming up on today's show, we unpack the 2024 budget and what this means for First Nations people and communities. NITV Radio chats to acclaimed First Nations soprano Sarah Presswidge, who stars in the upcoming opera Parwang Lifts the Sky, a stunning country creation story kicking off from the 10th of May at Malthouse Theatre in Naarm. NITV Radio also shares part of Living Black's interview with the iconic Arnie Barb McGrady. Carla Grant speaks with Arnie Barb about her life, her career behind the camera and her inspiration. And we share a few stories from our NITV news team. All these stories and more coming up after the latest news headlines.
Australia Day 1972 saw the first Aboriginal embassy erected outside Parliament.
The native title legislation must be amended.
And they've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
In this bulletin, the government says its new federal budget is both for the present and for the future. We unpack the 2024 budget and what this means for First Nations people and communities. And 8 TikTok creators are suing the United States. The government says its new federal budget is both for the present and the future. Treasurer Jim Chalmers acknowledges the cost of living pressures faced by Australians at home and the weakening global economy. Just over $6 billion goes to investment in new housing, with an extra $1 billion going to states and territories for new housing. There's also extra help for renters. The government's planning to invest $9.5 billion in infrastructure over the next 4 years as part of a total projected spend of $16.5 billion over 10 years. That'll include $1.2 billion for Queensland's direct Sunshine Coast rail line, Melbourne's North East Link and WA's Metronet rail project. $2.8 billion goes to strengthen Medicare, including $90 million to make it simpler for overseas health practitioners to work in Australia. Another $2.2 billion is committed to reforming the aged care sector and implement recommendations from the Royal Commission into aged care quality. The government says it's committed to getting the National Disability Insurance Scheme back on track with just under $500 million invested. Over $1 billion will be spent on paying superannuation on government-funded paid parental leave. A significant investment is made in a project called A Future Made in Australia. This $22.7 billion package aims to attract investment in key industries and turn Australia into a renewable energy superpower. There's $2 billion in development assistance to the Pacific region and just over $500 million funding to strengthen ties with Southeast Asia. The government says the suicide rate for First Nations people doubled that of the rest of the population is a national tragedy. It's allocated $12.8 million in the budget towards suicide prevention. Another $10 million has been allocated to the National Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation to deliver culturally appropriate mental health support. $12.5 million will be spent facilitating the distribution of menstrual products in regional and remote First Nations communities, which are currently expensive and hard to get. Budget 2024 invest $76 million over the next 5 years on the establishment of a new First Nations prison to employment program. Another $11 million will go to the Justice Policy Partnership, aiming at reducing the rates of adult and youth incarceration. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Services will get $15 million and nearly $9 million will go to Family Violence Prevention Legal Services. The government has also announced plans to develop a new First Nations education policy. $75 million will also extend investment over 4 years in a number of existing First Nations education programs. $33 million will be spent in the next school calendar year on school engagement programs for First Nations boys and young men. During the run-up to the Voice referendum last year, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said this was a once-in-a-generation opportunity, and that's the case in Budget 2024. There's no federal funding for any version of an Indigenous voice to Parliament, either in a local or regional context. This is the first budget since the government's launched the Working for Women, a National Strategy for Gender Equality. The budget invests nearly $1 billion to the Leaving Violence program to support those leaving a violent partner. $1 billion goes towards social housing for young people and women and children fleeing violence. Tax cuts later in the year will provide greater tax relief to low and middle-income taxpayers who are disproportionately women. Minister for Women Katie Gallagher says Labor is focused on reaching gender equality in Australia.
You should see this as continued progress on the list of things each budget we've been trying to gently and sometimes not so gently shift the dial on support for women and promoting a gender equal Australia, because we know that's good for everyone, not just women.
The government is investing a further $110 million in the National Criminal Insurance Scheme. The investment will improve information sharing between law enforcement agencies to help them respond better to criminal activity. It will allow law enforcement officers across Australia to access cross-border policing information and criminal intelligence in real time. The government says the NCIS enhances the safety of women and children by providing police with access to key information from multiple agencies on a single national database. To other news now, 8 TikTok creators are suing the United States in a lawsuit, arguing the federal law to ban the popular social media platform is a violation of users' rights to free speech. The lawsuit brings another challenge to a new federal law that will ban TikTok if its China-based parent company, ByteDance, does not sell its stakes within 1 year. US politicians say they are concerned about how well the app can protect user data from Chinese authorities and argue the app's algorithm may be used to spread Chinese propaganda. TikTok CEO Xu Zhiqiu says the ban is ironic because the free expression on TikTok reflects the American value of free speech.
As you may have heard, Congress passed a bill that the president signed into law that is designed to ban TikTok in the United States. That will take TikTok away from you and 170 million Americans who find community and connection on our platform. Make no mistake, this is a ban on TikTok and a ban on you and your voice. Politicians may say otherwise, but don't get confused. Many who sponsored the bill admit a TikTok ban is the ultimate goal.
Organisers of Australian Fashion Week say the tighter economic environment has meant Australian designers showcased at the event are changing tactics. Over the week, organisers say 30,000 people are expected to attend, with people tuning in to watch the online streaming from 50 countries around the world. The managing director of Australian Fashion Week, Natalie Zernitar, says there is a focus on consumers, with Australian designers using the event to showcase why their designs and quality are worth celebrating.
There's no doubt that consumers are tightening up their spending, but Australian Fashion Week is all about showcasing the quality clothing that Australian designers are renowned the world over for producing. Quality garments that are built to last are so much more important now in a consumer's purchasing decision. Designs that will be standing the test of time and in the long run have a much lower cost per wear, as well as not having the environmental impact that fast fashion option does have.
And in rugby league, Gold Coast and Brisbane have been rocked by injuries ahead of the NRL's Magic Round. The Titans are worst hit, with number 6 AJ Brimson and winger Phil Sami both set to miss at least a month with hamstring injuries. Captain Kieran Foran will also miss at least a week. In some good news, though, outside back Harley Smith-Shields saw a surgeon for a pectoral injury, and it's revealed he has not suffered a season-ending full rupture, as coach Des Hasler initially feared. The Broncos, meanwhile, have lost hooker Billy Walters to a wrist injury for Friday night's clash with Manly. That has allowed 20-year-old Blake Mozer to come on the bench and Tyson Smoothie to start. And now for a look at today's weather. Broome, sunny 32. Perth, also sunny 28. Adelaide, partly cloudy 21. Melbourne, much the same 18. Hobart, cloudy 18. Albury-Wodonga, mostly sunny 19. Canberra, partly cloudy 18. Wollongong, cloudy 21. Sydney, partly cloudy 22. Newcastle, a possible shower 22. Brisbane, much the same, 22. Townsville, partly cloudy, 29. Cairns, showers increasing, 29. Alice Springs, sunny, 25. Darwin, also sunny, 33. And the Torres Strait Islands, a possible shower, 31. And that is NITV Radio News.
Your community, your conversation. NITV Radio.
Welcome back. I'm your host, Luana Grant, and you're listening to NITV Radio. Still to come on the show, NITV Radio chats to acclaimed First Nations soprano Sarah Presswidge, who stars in the upcoming opera Parwang Lifts the Sky, a stunning country creation story. And NITV Radio shares part of Living Black's interview with the iconic Aunty Barb McGrady. But first, we share a few stories from our NITV news team. A 16-year-old sprinter who is one of the most promising runners in the country is awaiting confirmation of her place in Australia's track and field team for the Paralympic Games in Paris. Walpri woman Talia Blacksmith has already broken several national records, and her success is shining a light on some of the barriers impacting disabled Indigenous athletes. Brianna Holden with this story.
16-year-old Talia Blacksmith is on the precipice of becoming just one of a handful of Indigenous Paralympians.
I would probably start tearing up because I always wanted to do that, because just to be like Kathy Freeman and go at a 16 age as well is pretty good.
Born to compete, the Walpri teenager is in hot pursuit of a coveted seat on the plane to Paris 2024, breaking records as a short and middle distance runner and successfully trying her luck in long jump.
Let all the worries from aside and just focus on what's right in front of me and thinking about my family and how I'm going to like make them proud and all my culture.
Talia is yet another example of First Nations excellence in sport, but the journey for any Indigenous Australian para-athlete is tough. Growing up in La Jemanu, 870 kilometres south of Darwin, the T20 athlete was diagnosed with an intellectual impairment at age 5, impacting her short-term memory. In order to access the specialists needed for Talia, her parents and 3 siblings packed up and moved from her community in the Northern Territory to New South Wales. Not deterred by her diagnosis, her parents encouraged her to take up little athletics and soon realised Talia had a very special talent. In the last 4 years, she's broken several national and international records, gaining well-deserved recognition across track and field.
Sometimes I don't even know that I get the time, so I just run it and like I go hard every time. And I know it will hurt at the end of the finish line, but afterwards, it feels good.
Nadi Simpson is one of the founders of Sydney-based band Stiff Gins, but now she's involved in a different sort of musical project, directing a choir called Baragal. It's a place where First Nations and non-Indigenous Australians gather to sing in Indigenous languages. Supported by musicians from the Sydney University Conservatorium of Music, the choir is making songs inspired by culture.
Choir practice is about to begin at the Redfern Community Centre.
How are you?
The group is eager to learn a new song from choir director Nadi Simpson. The Stiff Gins musician teaches songs to choir members from the University of Sydney and any First Nations person who wants to join Bereagle. Staff and students from the Sydney Conservatorium of Music improvise. Together, Bereagle sings Hello in Gamilaray.
Us singing language gives me the joy of who I am and where I'm from, and it's a beautiful gift too for non-Indigenous people to sing Ngunnawal language or to think about a word that means a whole landscape of stuff.
This just shows how we are all welcome to bring our cultures together, led by First Nations.
Nadi is teaching the names of birds that live at Narran Lake near Walgett in northwest New South Wales. It's her country, and she took Bereagle there last year to perform for elders.
Nadi is singing out there about those birds, and all of a sudden the birds, you can see it chirping in the back there. It's absolutely beautiful. And she sang it, and the birds are there sort of joining in with the song. Absolutely fantastic.
So when those little birds, you know, sang back to us, we've been singing their name down here for 2 years and they sang back, and it was just the confirmation that you're always connected.
Bereagle is learning songs to return to Narran Lake in October for more performances.
I really love to kind of use language when we're singing. It makes me think, wow, fantastic, language is really coming. You know, coming back, and we're really revitalising it, and she's right at the forefront of it, so I'm excited to be involved in any way.
I arrived in Australia 30 years ago, so for me it's just another privilege of knowledge and of sharing, and a privilege to be invited to share those words with her, you know.
First Nations music stars, a non-Indigenous Australian sharing knowledge, culture and understanding in song. Felicity Ogilvie, NITV News.
For more than 50 years, First Nations superheroes have paved a path to greater representation in pop culture. But some say more needs to be done to break away from traditional stereotypes in the art form. Our Northern Territory correspondent Emma Kellaway caught up with a Darwin artist hoping to do just that.
Since childhood, Jonathan Saunders has looked to comics as a source of entertainment and inspiration.
Since I was a kid, I always had a love for, you know, art, storytelling, comics and animation. Grew up as a kid reading, you know, The Phantom and Mad magazine because they were easily accessible on the, you know, the grocery store racks.
But as a Wapabara man growing up on Larrakia country in the Northern Territory, finding First Nations characters he could relate to was something he struggled with.
Always found, I think when it comes to the American portrayals of Indigenous comic book characters, they tend to kind of go a bit on the, not there for the stereotypical side.
On a mission to challenge what he calls the Dreamtime Warrior stereotype, Jonathan began drawing on his own life to create a series with more diverse representation.
It was important when creating Zero Point to kind of create a character that was just, I guess, more of a reflection of myself as an urban Indigenous man.
Since its release in 2014, the Zero Point series has gone on to become part of a collection spanning five decades. The Black Power catalogue is a first of its kind, documenting the contributions of First Nations characters in the comic world.
It's important for people to come into face-to-face with a superhero TV show or a comic book or a work of art and be reminded that, you know, superheroes come in many shapes and sizes and genders and, you know, sexualities, and that was something that we really wanted to embrace and highlight.
For Jonathan, having a record of the past is an important step in paving a way forward.
It's really important to, at least for now, make a start and catalogue, you know, those characters and the importance they play in pop culture. The Zero Point comic is probably more aimed towards teenage boys, you know, maybe inspire them to tell their own stories as well.
Emma Kellaway, NITV News.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to NITV Radio. Next up, we share part of Living Black's interview with the iconic Aunty Barb McGrady. Carla Grant speaks with Aunty Barb about her life, her career behind the camera and her inspiration.
Aunty Barbara, welcome to Living Black.
Thank you.
Well, we're here interviewing you at the Chow Chak Wing Museum at the University of Sydney, where you have a wonderful exhibition of your images on display. Did you ever imagine as a child that your work would be celebrated in this way?
Not at all. Never. Of course, I was always hopeful of putting our stories out there in some kind of capacity, but because I always loved image making and photography from a very young age.
So it's a dream come true?
Oh, it really is, yes. It's more than I expected.
Well, you're a Gomeroi, Gamilaroi, Murray, Yinna woman, born in the town of Mungindi in New South Wales. What does your connection to country mean to you?
It means everything. It's my identity, it's who I am, it's my big mob, it's my country, where I come from, where I grew up, where I lived a good part of my life. I left Mungindi when I was 18 and moved to Brisbane, which was the closest, biggest city to where we lived.
And how important was your family's influence on your worldview?
Very important. My parents spoke language when they could, because they weren't allowed to speak their language and tell stories through language or dance, but they kept it alive by speaking to mob when we travelled to Tumala, where my father's mob came from.
You've said that your father was a great reader and that you first saw images of successful black sports people in the magazines he was given by the station owner where he worked. What did you think when you saw those pictures?
I thought they were pretty extraordinary, seeing these great images of black people. They were celebrities, actors, singers, sportsmen and women, and I thought, well, where's our images of our people? Why aren't they there? I just wanted that as a child.
Do you think that was the birth of your interest in photography?
I think so, because I look for people who look like me, had the same worldview as me. And I could see from images that they were people like us.
Well, your mum gave you a camera when you were about 15 years old. Did she know that photography was going to be your calling in life?
I'm not sure. Maybe she did. I always thought my mum was very wise. She was very caring. I come from a big family. So she always tried to give me things that I was interested in, even though, you know, we were very poor, but my father always worked. Life was hard, but I love the way I grew up with my parents and being mom.
Did you feel the need to document the injustice Indigenous people faced right from the beginning?
I did. I felt like that as a child, because we lived on the margins. I just felt that everything was different for us in this small town I grew up in. We had to sit down the front in the hard seat at the local picture show. We couldn't try on clothes in shops. We had to be out of town before 6 o'clock at night. So I always felt the difference in the way we were treated and always thought, why? We're on our own land. This is who we are. That's the way I felt.
Well, we're on the grounds of Sydney University. You actually studied sociology here.
I always had some kind of connection here. I had a lot of friends that came here as students and then came back later to lecture. And I came here to sit in on talks on anthropology and things like that, even before I was a student. Always attended rallies and protests. There was always something going on here.
Did university life like have a big impact on you?
It really did, because you meet all kinds of people from all parts of the world who have a different worldview, who don't or didn't know that much about Aboriginal people. They didn't know their history, like a lot of people here still don't. And so it was always a place to meet new people and have great talks and learn about their culture and where they come from.
So during the 70s, a time of great Aboriginal activism in Sydney, you must have seen a lot during that time. What were the highlights you saw as a photographer?
There was always some kind of political protest or big rallies for black rights and land rights, of course. People like my old friend, Gary Foley, he was always at big rallies where he spoke of land rights mainly and black rights. So there was always something going on of that nature. But I can't put my finger on one thing, because it was a time where there was always some kind of protest and rally.
How did your sociology degree fit in with your plans to be a photographer?
That's a hard question, but I think I see the world in a sociological sense, where we're all some way, somehow connected, and we all have to live in this world, in this country, in this community. So that's the way I looked at it.
Do you think it helped you to be a better photographer?
I think so. I think it really does, because it's a particular way of looking at the world and the people and connections.
Well, this is a quote from you. When you are born Aboriginal in this country, your life becomes part of the injustice. You see your life as always being political. Is that a burden for First Nations people to carry, that we always have to fight?
It can be seen in that way. But I myself never, ever saw it as a burden. In the big picture, in the big frame, it is, because we are only 3% of the population. And since colonialism, 230 plus years ago, we're still fighting for our rights. There's still injustice, there's still racism, and I think we all encounter it in different ways. I never let that hold me back. I never looked at it like that, but I could see in the scheme of things, that's the way it was. Sometimes still is.
Why do you say it's a responsibility of Indigenous people to tell their stories, to keep it real and fight for what they believe in?
Why? Because I think if you are born Aboriginal, it is something inside you that should make you see that you have to put yourself out there to tell our story, to tell things the way they are, the way it is. Be proud of who you are.
Then the black man will think like a black man, and he will feel for other black people. And this new thinking and feeling will cause black people to stick together.
You often quote Malcolm X, who said, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. Why do you like that quote?
Oh, I think it's very profound. We all know who Malcolm X was. I'm a child of the 60s, 70s. I grew up in that era. I was always very political, and we always looked to America for the black revolutionary figures such as Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, James Baldwin, people like that. I always looked to what they said and how they did things. But I always was well aware of my own mob and how we progressed and saw things.
And that was Carla Grant sitting down with Aunty Barb McGrady on Living Black. And you can catch this full episode on SBS On Demand. We'll be back with more after the break.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to NITV Radio. Next up, I chat to acclaimed First Nations soprano Sarah Presswidge, who is starring in Deborah Cheatham's celebrated opera, Pawang Lifts the Sky. Sarah chatted to me about her journey into opera and her passion being a mentor to other First Nations people in this space through her work with Short Black Opera.
My name is Sarah Prestwich. I'm a proud Burrabarrungal Gunnamagal Darug woman. I live out on Darawal land, or grew up on Darawal land, I should say, because I currently live in London.
Wow, and you're back in Australia now because you're in a performance which is coming up?
Yes, so I am performing the title role of Pawang in Pawang Lifts the Sky with Victorian Opera. So currently in Melbourne at the moment in rehearsals for that, which is going wonderfully.
Amazing. And can you tell us a little bit more about your role in this production?
Of course. So actually, the way that it came up was that Deborah Cheatham Freyon actually wrote the role, the title role of Pawang for me many years ago in 2020. But unfortunately, because of the pandemic and my studies in the UK, I wasn't able to come back and perform the role, which was really sad. But I'm so grateful to be back here now and honoured to finally get to do this role that was written for me.
And I'll just go back a little bit. Would you mind telling us a little bit more about like your background and journey into the world of opera and performance?
Yeah, so I think that I come from a long line of Yellamundi or storytellers. However, I was raised by two hardcore rock and roll fans. So the journey into opera was certainly left field, to say the least. I, you know, as a young kid, I always loved singing. I was in the Australian Youth Choir. I had piano lessons, sang musical theatre. But I always wanted to be like the next Casey Chambers or Delta Goodrum, that kind of music. It really wasn't until someone in high school, a teacher, suggested, hey, you should have a look at classical music. And my parents jumped straight to Google and found me a teacher that happened to be an opera singer. And so I dragged my parents to my first opera and theirs. And honestly, I remember sitting in the audience just thinking, man, this is epic. You know, the wash of the orchestra and the amazing costumes. And I mean, the sheer fact that they're not singing with microphones. I just thought this is 100% what I want to do. So I just, you know, I had my eyes set on going to Sydney Conservatorium, and I got in to the music education degree, and I actually studied to be a music teacher, a classroom music teacher, as well as obviously doing classical voice on the side of that. And during those years, I did a lot of work with Koori Radio. I taught at Dharma Festival. I did a lot of outreach programs. And I was introduced to Deborah Cheatham Freyon, who was an incredible mentor for me and turned out to be probably one of my greatest champions. And so, yeah, from that moment forward, I've done a lot of work with Short Black Opera. And, of course, in 2020, I got into the Royal Northern College of Music. I was really blessed to get a full scholarship, and I couldn't have done it without one. And, of course, the Martin Bequest Travelling Scholarship, which helped a lot as well through the Council of the Arts. And, I've just been freelancing for the last couple of years in London and working with companies such as Opera Holland Park. Feeling really lucky to be brought back home now to do this role.
Yeah, such an amazing journey. And living overseas, like you've been living in the UK, what's that like? What's that experience like? And being so far from home and family, but also getting to like live your dreams and, you know, live overseas and do all these amazing things. What's that like, that experience like for you?
Yeah, I think unfortunately there is kind of a bit of a prevailing idea that international recognition leads to a unique credibility here in Australia and opens up more opportunities here in Australia. And I think particularly because of my work with Short Black Opera and my outreach work and advocacy work, I really saw that it was really important for me to, or an opportunity for me to set a powerful example for other Indigenous artists. So I really hoped that by venturing overseas, I'd be able to be a testament for, you know, leaving one's country to explore and refine whatever it is that you know, whatever path anyone's going on, to go over and pursue that career and then come back and share it with others. I think the coaches and the opportunities overseas are just enormous. I mean, we obviously live on an island over here, so it's much harder to get to Europe and have that kind of accessibility and visibility to the rest of the world. And as an opera singer, that's really important. And just kind of, I guess, being in the places where a lot of these, more mainstream and traditional operas are, opposed to not contemporary operas, were written. It's really cool to be over there and learn the craft from the birthplace, I guess.
And you mentioned that, you know, you're really passionate about music education for First Nations people and being, yeah, you know, an advocate and also like a mentor. And you did mention a little bit about the work that you've done with Short Black Opera. Can you tell us a little bit more about that side of it and also what it's like to, you know, be that mentor and support for other First Nations people that might want to get into what you're doing?
Yeah, of course. So I think I've always really just enjoyed giving music to people, whether that be in education or as a performer. I think giving music where it's absent is really important. And, you know, the benefits of music are really too good for people to not be exposed to it. That's always been a really big passion of mine. When I was at Sydney University, I initiated the very first Sydney University Indigenous Ensemble. And we had the privilege of working with Uncle Richard Green, the late Uncle Richard Green, who, is a brilliant, brilliant man. And I had my first experience singing in language with him, and I learned a lot from working with him. And from there, as I said, I did some work at Koori Radio working with First Nations songwriters as well, up-and-coming songwriters, and then had the opportunity to go to Garma Festival where, you know, I got to teach out on the Red Sand, which was a lifetime opportunity and experience. With Short Black Opera, we do a lot of brilliant work with young musicians, both instrumentalists and singers. And it's, yeah, really important about giving them the music education and the musical opportunities. And hopefully so that we can have more of us on stages. I think there's very few of us working with the big opera companies in Australia, and I'm lucky to be sharing the stage with a few First Nations artists this year. But of course, it would be amazing to have a full cast of us.
Yeah, it would be amazing. And you're, you know, obviously someone that people will be looking up to and hopefully aspiring to get to where you've gotten to in your career. But just circling back now to Pawang Lifts the Sky, you are in rehearsals at the moment. And how's that going in the lead up to the premiere night?
It's going so well. And yesterday we had the opportunity to go out onto country, which was an incredible experience. And I'm not sure if you are aware, but Pawang Lifts the Sky is based on a Wadawurrung Dreamtime story, the creation story. And so we were able to get out there on country and see these significant sites and hear more about the story and, of course, see Bundle, the creator's final resting place as well. And I mean, today in rehearsals we worked on the final scene, the Council of the Birds, and I got really emotional because I think just having that context, it was a really powerful moment to sing that today after having been out on country, and just to have really the whole cast, all the creatives, the entire team, media, everyone was there from Victorian Opera out on country. And I thought that was a really, really special moment for us.
Yeah, it sounds beautiful. And I guess what do you hope, you know, the audience will take away from this production when they see it and getting to experience it?
Yeah, well, I mean, ultimately, Pawang Lifts the Sky, it is a First Nations story, but it's also, it's a very Australian story. We've all heard the magpies in the morning. We've all probably experienced being swooped by a magpie.
And definitely.
Just hearing the story about how that, the relationship that with the Wadawurrung First Nations creation story and how that ties in with that. I think there's lots of fabulous little jokes in there and obviously some stunning music, and I think it's going to be hard for anyone to not walk away having had a really good time.
Yeah, and the production kicks off from the 10th of May running through to the 18th of May at Malthouse Theatre in Nam, Melbourne, for anyone who'd like to see it. But Sarah, thank you so much for joining me on NITV Radio, and all the best with the shows coming up, and hopefully I can get down to see it as well, because I'd love to come and watch.
Yes, that'll be brilliant. And also, I just want to obviously give a big shout out to any mob that wants to come down. Obviously, we have MobTix available too, so you can use that code via the Victorian Opera website or the Malthouse Theatre website as well, using the code MobTix in the promotional code section. So come along.
Amazing. Thank you so much. And it was so great to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
And that's all we have time for on today's program. You can listen back to the show anytime online or catch any of our stories on our website. NITV Radio will be back on Friday with more stories from right across the country. I'm your host, Luana Grant. Thanks so much for listening and have a great day.
Fire. You can't break this vibe or keep us quiet.